Please be seated. Before we begin, you will notice that we are sitting six. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who generally sits on my right, has withdrawn from participation in this case, so she will not be participating. Okay, so with that brief announcement, I'll call our second case, Carrera versus Woodman's Food Market. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed?
Madam Chief Justice, may it please this court, my name is Eric Knobloch, and along with my co-counsel, Michael Lococo, represent Jose Carrera. This court should reverse the Court of Appeals and direct the Circuit Court to enter judgment in favor of Jose Carrera because the jury had sufficient evidence at trial to infer the time element for constructive notice in a safe place case. By overturning the Court of Appeals in this case, the court has the opportunity to clarify Kanchansky, reaffirm the appropriate role of appellate review when reviewing jury verdicts, and expound upon the necessary role of inference and circumstantial evidence by the jury when it analyzes video evidence. Jose Carrera brought suit after slipping and falling in the dairy substance on an unknown dairy product in the Woodman's Food Mart. The incident occurred in one of the busiest areas of the store and one prone to spills up to five times per day. Woodman's surveillance video captured the incident. Woodman's preserved the fall and exactly 10 minutes prior to the fall.
Counsel, is it fair to assume all the things that you're saying to us right now are facts that are in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. Those are facts that are in the record.
And facts that the jury heard?
Those are facts that the jury heard, correct.
Okay.
Suit was brought under Wisconsin Statute 10111, commonly known as the Safe Place Statute. The statute places a higher burden on business owners. In this case, it requires Woodman's to do everything reasonable to make the premises as safe as the nature of the premises would reasonably permit. A key element of proof for the jury's determination is notice. Notice can be actual notice of a dangerous condition or constructive notice of a dangerous condition, knew or should have known. For constructive notice, the jury must determine the dangerous condition existed for a sufficient length of time to allow a business owner to discover and remedy the situation.
How obvious does the safety problem have to be before we attribute that to the owner?
That is, Your Honor, that is a question for the jury, as this court has held in Burmack v. Miller Brewing and Warner v. Gimbel Brothers. That is a question for the jury based upon the nature of the premises, the nature of the condition, and the facts and circumstances surrounding each case. The two seminal cases.
That's never challengeable then as a question of law?
That is challengeable as a question of law, and that is one of the focus that the Court of Appeals. And as a matter of law, the standard of review when looking at that jury determination is whether there was any credible evidence to sustain the jury verdict. Tasked with that standard of review, the Court of Appeals is to search the record or any reasonable inference and any evidence that may sustain the jury verdict.
And the question of how obvious the defect is, that's separate and apart from how long it was there, correct?
Correct. This court has held that is a consideration for the jury to determine, and it's a very fact-specific inquiry based on the nature of the premises, the dangerous condition, and perhaps other factors the jury may deem appropriate.
So give me an example of what a court could legitimately look at in deciding, you know, in this case, the defect was not sufficiently obvious to give rise to constructive notice. What kind of things would the court be looking at?
Certainly that could be a reasonable inference based on the evidence, and a jury could have reached that conclusion. But at the trial court level, the jury reached a different conclusion.
I get that. I'm just looking at in general. So someone comes to the Court of Appeals and they say, look, there's no way. I mean, regardless of how long this was there, there's no way it could be reasonable to expect us to notice that. So can the Court of Appeals entertain that argument? And if it can, what are the factors that it would be considering in determining whether that defect was sufficiently of a sufficient degree that they should have noticed it?
Certainly that is something a jury may take into consideration, and therefore a Court of Appeals may as well. And I think that goes to the nature of the premises and perhaps the nature of the business. I guess I can envision a scenario, say in a hospital, if there's, say, ice in the hallway. That may be a situation where a jury determines there doesn't need to be any length of time for that to be an inappropriate, dangerous condition that, as in that case, a hospital should have been aware of and should have remedied it. On the other end of that spectrum is perhaps an ice rink. If there is ice somewhere perhaps where it shouldn't be in an ice rink where you would naturally expect it to probably be, a jury may say 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever time period may not be enough given the circumstances and the premises for a reasonable business owner to appreciate it and remedy the situation.
Sure, and that goes to the length of time that the condition exists. I'm interested in is, and the reason I'm interested in it is because there's a substantial amount of discussion in the briefs about, who noticed it or didn't notice it, or whether it was noticeable. If you're 10 steps away, can you see it? Apparently Mr. Correa himself, after having slipped on it 10 steps away, he couldn't see it. So what I'm wondering is, what is the test for a court of appeals to use in looking at the defective condition and saying, setting aside for a moment how long it existed, looking at it and saying, is that the sort of thing that we will charge the business owner with constructive notice of?
I think it's appropriate for a jury to determine that question on a fact-specific basis.
I know the juries, that is what juries do. But on review, and as you've said, that's a legitimate question for the Court of Appeals to look at. So what I'm wondering is, if it's a legitimate question for the Court of Appeals to look at it, what standard does it use in reviewing that question?
I think an appropriate standard, if the Court is looking for a standard on the length of time, is some length of time.
Not interested in length of time. I'm interested in how noticeable is that defect.
Oh, I think I understand what you're asking now, and I think it goes on a case-by-case basis on who noticed it and how they noticed it. In this particular case, even though you are correct that Mr. Correa, after he fell, looked back and could not see it, it is also true that when the Woodman's employee, Buckner, walked up to it just seconds later, he had no trouble observing two identifiable spots of a substance and was able to observe it and clean it. And he had no problem noticing those seconds after the fact.
Was there any evidence on how frequently Woodman's cleaned the dairy aisle?
There was evidence to that effect, and it was nightly. They had a professional service.
So they didn't have someone that came in every 45 minutes and cleaned the aisle, or every 2 hours and cleaned the aisle. It was just at night.
Not specifically. There was at night a nightly cleaning service, but all the employees were trained specifically to look for spills given the nature of the store. If you're not familiar with the store, it's a very large store with a lot of products and a lot of customers and a lot of employees. And their employees are specifically tasked with looking for dangerous conditions, and they are instructed to remedy those almost immediately.
When we're talking about standards that Justice Kelly was asking, don't we just go back to any reasonable inference because that's the standard of review that we're looking at here?
I would agree with that the jury was specifically asked to, jury instruction 230, I believe, to consider circumstantial evidence. They are instructed that it may be as proper and as effective as direct evidence, and they are allowed to consider that circumstantial evidence along with all reasonable inferences. And the Court of Appeals, understanding that factor, is to search the record for any evidence that would support the jury's conclusion. It is my contention, is our contention, that the Court of Appeals erred in that regard. They applied a standard of appellate review that ignored the circumstantial evidence and ignored the reasonable inferences, reweighed the evidence and came to a conclusion that, in their view, was the more reasonable inference. And it may have been a reasonable inference, but it was not the reasonable inference reached by the jury in this matter. The case most heavily relied upon by the Court of Appeals in this matter is the most recent Safe Place case to come before this court, and that is the Kochansky case. Kochansky case is vastly different than the case at hand for two distinct reasons. First, Kochansky was winter in Wisconsin, a slip and fall on ice outside of a gas station. That was a natural accumulation of ice. This case, the substance was on the floor of a business in an area most prone to spills. This court has repeatedly emphasized that the length of time depends on the surrounding facts and circumstances, including the nature of the business and the nature of the condition. Secondly, and most importantly, Kochansky was before this court primarily as a missing witness instruction case. The missing witness instruction was provided by the circuit court because plaintiff called no witnesses and defendant failed to any store managers or employees. The missing witness instruction was given, and therefore the plaintiff received the negative inference, and the jury was instructed that they may infer from the unavailability of the witnesses that they would have testified against the gas station owner in that case. The court held that that was improperly given, and because there was no other evidence to sustain the jury's verdict on the length of time the dangerous condition was present, that there was no credible evidence, none, to sustain the jury's verdict. In this case, the jury had sufficient evidence to determine the substance was there long enough that Woodman's should have known about it. The evidence. There is no dispute that Mr. Correa actually slipped on a dairy substance in the dairy aisle of the Woodman's food market. Although the substance was not visible on the video, it was clearly visible to Mr. Buckner just seconds after the fall. Therefore, it was clearly on the ground for some length of time.
Is it undisputed that it was a white substance, too? Was the evidence clear on that?
There was no contrary evidence. I think it was pretty undisputed that it was a white, dairy-like substance. There was any number of substances it maybe could have been, but it was narrowed down as a white, dairy-like substance. Because it was on the ground for some length of time, there are plenty of inferences from that evidence to conclude, for the jury to conclude, the length of time was long enough that Woodman's should have known about it.
Counsel, one of the inferences that you contend is reasonable is it might have been there for more than 90 minutes because we've got the testimony. We've got the 10-minute video, and we see no evidence of how it might have been deposited there. We have testimony that the 90 minutes that the store looked at and didn't see anything there. If we didn't have the 90-minute testimony, does that change the analysis at all? Is 10 minutes long enough, you think, as well, for the jury to create the reasonable inference there?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe 10 minutes is plenty long enough. The 90 minutes that you alluded to came from a Woodman's employee who testified that not only did they see and they pulled the 10 minutes beforehand, that particular employee observed the 90 minutes beforehand and didn't see where the substance came from. A reasonable inference is that perhaps the jury just didn't believe him, that he either didn't watch it or he wasn't looking or whatever it may be. But back to your point, is the 10 minutes long enough? My contention is that given the facts and circumstances of the particular business and how busy that area is trafficked and how many employees were there, 10 minutes, perhaps the jury, I think, did conclude that 10 minutes was long enough.
Well, perhaps the jury also concluded because the employee who didn't save all of the tape, said he didn't see anything spilled during 90 minutes, that it was there longer than 90 minutes, right?
That is correct. That's another inference that the jury may have arrived at, that we acknowledge that you claim you watched 90 minutes of it and didn't see it. You only preserved 10 minutes. We don't believe you. That's a reasonable
I don't think you even have to go to the second step and say, we don't believe you, that you didn't see anything spilled during the 90 minutes. But if it's there, during the time he falls, and nobody is putting it there during 90 minutes prior to that, you could conclude it's been there for more than 90 minutes, right?
I believe the evidence supports that inference and that conclusion, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
There is two main pieces of circumstantial evidence to support the inference and conclusion of the jury that the substance was there for longer than 10 minutes. At the 6-minute mark of the video, or about 4 minutes before Mr. Correa fell, the video shows a man in a red jacket, as he's been come to know. We didn't hear him testify, but he appears to look down in the exact area where Mr. Correa later fell. He looks down, looks around, and goes about his way. Circumstantial evidence that there was something on the ground at that 4-minute mark. He looked at it, perhaps wanted to do something, decided not to, and then walked on. But it's a circumstantial evidence that supports the inference that the substance was there for longer than 10 minutes.
This is the same person that Woodman's says was just looking at products on the shelf?
Correct. That is Woodman's interpretation of the video, and I would submit that while perhaps that is a fair inference, I see it differently, and I submit that the jury saw it differently and reached a different conclusion.
I watched the video, but I just watched the one piece of it. I'm going back to your 10 minutes is long enough, because I think you have to look at the whole thing. We're not parceling it out because we have the 90-minute issue also. But with respect to your comment about the 10 minutes, were there other employees that walked past during those 10 minutes? I mean, wouldn't that be part of when we talk about what's long enough and what's reasonable? 10 minutes as a categorical rule wouldn't necessarily be long enough to have something spilled and not cleaned up, would it?
I don't think it's appropriate for this court to set a categorical rule, because I think it depends on the nature of the premises. But also on the video, Mr. Buckner, the Woodman's employee who eventually cleaned up the spill, he is seen on the video in that 10 minutes prior exactly two times, and he is pushing a load of goods to left to right on the video. This court has held in several different cases, including Caldwell versus Piggly Wiggly Madison and Radzinski versus Werner Theaters, that there is a plain sight exception to the safe place doctrine. The jury could have determined that a Woodman's trained employee who is trained to look for spills and clean them up missed it, and should have seen something that was in his plain sight not once, but twice. So I believe that also is the circumstantial evidence and provides a fair inference for the jury to conclude that not only was it there for the 10 minutes, which would be long enough, but that particular Woodman's employee, it was in his plain sight and he should have seen it. I've talked about the standard of review the lens with which the Court of Appeals was tasked to look at this, and that is the any credible evidence standard. And I think that is a good segue in the opportunity that this Court has to clarify the specific role the Court of Appeals has in appellate review. Court of Appeals is not the trier of fact. Court of Appeals is not to determine the credibility of the witnesses. The Court of Appeals is to search the record for evidence, accept the reasonable inferences, and accept the jury verdict if there is any evidence to support the jury verdict or any inferences that may be made from that direct or circumstantial evidence to support the jury verdict. Back to Kachansky for just a moment, because that was the case heavily relied on, and is this Court's last word on safe place law. I think it's important to analyze the evidence. In Kachansky, besides a video, there was no evidence as to the length of time the ice was present. Contrasting it with this case, we have the video. We have two people in the video. I mentioned one was the man in the red jacket. There is also another customer within that 10 minutes that it appears, and Woodman's agreed at the circuit court level, or at least a Woodman's employee did, that employee seems to take her cart and go around the exact area where the substance was later located, where Mr. Correa fell. That supports the second piece of circumstantial evidence that supports the inference that it was there for some period of time and supports the jury conclusion that it was a long enough period of time in this particular case for Woodman's to have, should have known about it and taken the opportunity to remedy it. One of counsel's arguments in the response brief was the need for the plaintiff to prove the exact length of time the dangerous condition has been there or when the dangerous condition started. First off, that premise and that argument has no basis in Wisconsin law. In fact, that is the exact terminology and the language of the jury instruction, which I believe is 8010, tells the jury that the length of time depends on the nature of the premises and the facts and circumstances. It would be wholly inappropriate to hold the plaintiff or any litigant to that standard being you need to prove the exact length of time a dangerous condition is there. That would pose several different problems. In most cases, the holder of that evidence is the business. So the litigant would always be subject to the difficulty of obtaining a video or preserving the correct video. Secondly, it would create an incredibly difficult, if not impossible, burden to prove the exact length of time a condition was there. For instance, while this isn't a case where someone slipped on ice on a business, you can imagine a scenario that if it was, and you were tasked with determining when that ice became a dangerous condition, when that puddle turned from water to ice, it would create an impossible standard for future litigants to meet. Lastly, this case presents an opportunity for this court to clarify and highlight the importance of the jury's ability to draw inferences from video evidence. Not only what the video shows, but what the video doesn't show. As the arbiters of the fact, in both civil and criminal cases, juries need broad latitude to infer based on video evidence. While there may be competing inferences on proof and competing inferences on intent if it is a criminal matter, juries need broad latitude to consider the circumstantial evidence and make inferences. One could suspect that as technology grows and as surveillance becomes more ubiquitous, this may be an issue that this court may have to face in future Safe Place cases where the video evidence is of poor quality or doesn't show what the substance is, but perhaps juries can draw other circumstantial evidence from it and draw different inferences from that. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to spending a few more minutes with you on rebuttal.
Very good.
May it please the court. Excuse me, my voice is...
I have the same thing, so
thank you.
Totally excused.
I'll do my best to use my outdoor voice.
Yep.
May it please the court. My name is Lisa Lawless of the law firm of Hush Blackwell. I represent Woodman's Food Market in this case. With me here today is the general counsel from Woodman's, Sarah Eagle Cholmi, and co-counsel Duffy Dillon. Woodman's asked the court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case. This is really a simple case, and it gives the court, the facts are undisputed as to both at the summary judgment phase of the case and at trial. It gives the court the opportunity to opine on what is necessary to draw inferences from evidence. It also gives the court the opportunity to discuss the circuit court's important role in summary judgment and what should the trial court do when faced with one of these cases, especially given undisputed facts, a video showing lack of proof, and the plaintiff not being able to prove a key element of their case.
You know what bothers me about this case? Why did Woodman save only 10 minutes when he reported his fall to Woodman's right away? Why did they save only 10 minutes?
Well, the testimony at trial was that the employee reviewed the 90 minutes of tape from prior to the fall and looked to see if there was any evidence of anything dropping on the floor in that aisle. There was no evidence of it that could be seen.
Yeah, I think that's contrary to Woodman's. As I look at it and give the jury's decision the most weight, the jury could have said, well, their own employee said nobody dropped it for 90 minutes. Therefore, it had to be there longer than 90 minutes because we know it was there because he wiped it off his shoe with a paper towel. So I don't think that helps Woodman, frankly, if you're trying to upset the jury's verdict.
Well, Woodman's appealed the denial of summary judgment as well, keep in mind. And it's an element of plaintiff's burden of proof in a safe place statute case when you're relying on constructive notice to prove the length of time that the hazard was there. And there is no evidence from which, there's no facts from which a jury could draw the inference that the material was there more than a few seconds,
minute. Sure there is. There's nothing on the video showing anything being deposited on the floor for 90 minutes by Woodman's own testimony. Yet we know it was there because he wiped it off his shoe with the paper towel that Woodman's employee gave to him. So clearly there was something there that he slipped on. And he slipped on it because he got his foot in it, or it wouldn't be on his shoe. So I think Woodman's puts itself in a bad place by not saving more of the video. But, you know, I don't take that as that the employee lied. If he looked at it and nothing happened in 90 minutes, but we know it was there, it's a reasonable inference a jury could make that it was there longer than 90 minutes.
Well, to determine length of time and draw inferences, there needs to be length of time how long the material was there. Case law for 100 years has established that just because there's salad dressing on the floor, just because there's something, a French fry on the floor, doesn't mean that's proof that it was there for a particular length of time.
Yeah,
there needs to be evidence.
No, if it's on the floor, I mean, post hoc ergo propter hoc is oftentimes a logical fallacy, but not here, right? The thing was there, whatever it was on the floor. We know because Mr. Correa slipped and fell on it, right? So you concede that, yes?
He had material on his pants, and the assumption is that had something to do with his slipping.
Yeah. So you're not contesting that that it was on the floor, right? You acknowledge that there was something on the floor that he slipped on. Yes?
Yes, I think yes.
Okay. And if there's something that was on the floor that he slipped on, it had to have come to that point at some specific point in time. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the 100 years of cases that address this were in a time and an age where we didn't have video evidence. Here we have videos, and the video covers the specific spot where he slipped and fell, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Although the video isn't, you can't see every single thing that occurs on the aisle. There could be something that is undetectable by the eye from the video.
Something undetectable by the video that would be capable of depositing whatever that was on the floor at that point?
It might have been obscured by a person. I mean, there's just different ways in which the video didn't pick up how the object got there.
So is Woodman's relying on the proposition that it could have gotten on the floor and not be captured by the video?
Well, I think that the point is that it got on the floor. There's no way to know when it got on the floor.
Right. Let's get to that in a second. But does your position depend on a conclusion that the substance could have gotten on the floor in a way that was not captured by the video?
That is one fact. That is a possible inference, yes.
Okay. Is a possible inference sufficient to overturn a jury verdict?
In this case,
yes or no first.
I think the way I worded it, probably not.
Okay.
But.
So you got to have something other than a possible inference.
Yes.
What have you got?
Well, Your Honor, you asked the question about what test would you apply to see if the material could be seen and whether it was there. The testimony of Mr. Correa.
I don't want to get, I want to get to that eventually, but I want to concentrate on the timing.
Can I get in line for when he's done?
And me?
So tell me what I've got in the evidence of record that is sufficient to tell me that the jury could not infer that the substance had been there for at least 10 minutes or even beyond that, the 90 minutes prior to that.
The jury couldn't. I would like to back up for a moment. The law provides that the plaintiff needs to prove the length of time the hazard was there. There is no evidence on the video it was dropped at 1 second, no evidence it was dropped at 1 minute, no evidence it was dropped at 10 minutes.
Right, so let me test that for a moment. So are you saying that the law is that there has to be proof of the definite commencement time?
I would say there needs to be some evidence going towards when it began. Sometimes
okay, so this,
there could
this
be
goes back
different
to my,
facts.
This goes back to my questions about the videos, and I want to make sure that I don't take up too much time for my colleagues here. So we have a video that from which we can clearly infer that there was a substance on the floor. There's nothing that shows us when it got there within that 10 minutes. And the Woodman's employee who reviewed the 90 minutes prior to that said there's no evidence of how it got there in that 90 minutes. So why is it not possible for the jury to infer from that it had been there for at least 100 minutes?
Because there is no evidence. In order to infer, you need to infer from facts. The jury inferring that it had been there more than 90 minutes is solely a guess. And so this goes back to our argument that...
But I can tell that water pitcher is on the table. And if I saw 100 minutes of video to show the water pitcher on the table, I can tell you I am dead on certain that it's been there for 100 minutes, right? Now, conversely, if the water table, if the water pitcher is not there, I can infer from its presence or its absence the amount of time based on the video evidence, right? Why can't one do that? This seems to be pretty simple logic.
In this case, the video shows the lack of evidence. So it's not Woodman's burden, it's the plaintiff's burden to prove that it was there a sufficiently long period of time that Woodman's will be deemed to have constructive notice to notice it and remedy it. And so, therefore, it needs to be noticeable, and the testimony and all the undisputed facts at trial and also presented on summary judgment were that no one saw it there. And the only time anyone knew it was there is when Mr. Correa fell.
So one more permutation, and then I'm done. So let's say that there's a piece of paper standing in front of the water pitcher, right? And so I can't see, I'm watching the video, I can't see the water pitcher, but at the very end, somebody pulls away the paper, and I see the water pitcher there. Okay, now I've watched 10 minutes of video, and I haven't seen anyone put a water pitcher there. Is it not fair for me to conclude from that the water pitcher had been there for 10 minutes?
Yes, because of the size of the water pitcher and the logical inference. In this case, inferring that a milky or white substance had been on the floor for 1 second, 1 minute, 10 minutes, 90 minutes is not a reasonable inference given the undisputed facts. And the law is that the Court of Appeals, the Circuit Court, can determine as a matter of law what is a reasonable inference when the facts are undisputed. You asked a question earlier about what do you need to prove that it could have been seen, which is, I think, a related question. In this case, there is no evidence that anyone walking by, 20 different customers walked down this aisle, and nobody slipped on the item, stumbled. No one was seen to have noticeably interacted with it. The 28 people walked past the line at which the substance was where Mr. Correa fell. You can't see it on the video. Mr. Correa said he didn't see the substance when he approached it, and he didn't see the substance after it fell. That is evidence that the material could not be seen merely by an employee walking at the perpendicular aisle. In determining a test for this kind of issue, you should ask, what type of substance is it? If it's a container of Kool-Aid that's spilled and it takes over the floor, certainly that can be seen easily. If it's a small, in the testimony in the record is from Mr. Correa is that he didn't know how large the amount of substance was when he saw it, but it sounded like it was a very small amount. Under the safe place law, the law is that...
I think you're reaching your end of answering the questions. I don't want to interrupt, though. Are you?
Yes,
complete?
Go ahead.
All right. For me, I wanted to get in sort of at the beginning because in my view, it's important to know which arguments you're making with respect to summary judgment and the denial of that. Are you also appealing directed verdict?
Yes.
And the denial of that?
Yes.
And which arguments being with respect to the insufficient evidence upon which the jury could base its decision? Because at least in my mind, those are distinct legal analysis. So what I'm hearing you do, which for me is not as helpful, but maybe it is for others, is you're answering individual questions sort of in a shotgun form, addressing evidence. And if this is purely a sufficiency of the evidence question, for me that's a tougher battle for you. If it's a summary judgment or directed verdict issue, I need to know exactly what you're saying there was no genuine issue of material fact concerning, or in directed verdict, how you meet that. So mine is more of a procedural and legal question and how you're addressing those concerns, and also the amicus brief that was submitted regarding your summary judgment concerns.
Can I tack on to your question? In responding to Justice Ziegler's questions, could you also address the standard of review, because it wasn't given a lot of attention in your brief, and I want to know if there's any disagreement with the other side as to how they've stated the standard
right.
of review.
I think those two things go hand in hand, because the way we look at things, we might think, oh, gosh. But you know what? If they would have ruled in favor of you, then the other side would say the same thing. But that's not our job to say what we would do. We didn't hear the evidence. They did. So walk me through those things and the standard of review.
Okay. Starting at the end with a directed verdict, the standard of review is if there is any credible evidence to support a ruling in favor of the plaintiff. And at the time Woodman's move for a directed verdict to the circuit court, this was before the jury issued its decision. Counsel for Woodman's argued and pointed out that the evidence in the record at trial did not prove the length of time the substance was on the floor, and that the law of the Safe Place statute requires proof as to how long the substance was on the floor. This stands to reason that the
you
point...
You need to prove exactly how long, right?
Not exactly, but there needs to be some bracketing evidence. And it could be disputed, certainly, facts as to when the substance began being there and compared to when the accident occurred.
So are you saying it's not disputed here?
And I'll move to summary judgment, Your Honor. On the summary judgment motion, the standard of review is this court performs the review of standard summary judgment de novo. And on summary judgment, Woodman's proved that Correa could not prove his burden of proving the elements of constructive notice. And to prove constructive notice requires proof that the material was there sufficiently long to give a reasonable operator time to notice it and remedy it.
Did you raise summary judgment on appeal, though? You did
not. Yes. It was raised in the Court of Appeals, and it was raised in the response to the petition for review.
Okay.
And in
raising
the court.
Raising this to us, though? You didn't.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Counsel?
It was raised in the response to the Court of Appeal, in the Court of Appeals, as one of the grounds for a reversal, and it was raised in response to the petition for review as an issue that needs to be decided, and it was raised in our substantive brief to this court.
Counsel, just piggybacking off of Justice Ziegler's question in relation to the amicus brief, and as you're bringing up summary judgment, and I just want to make sure I get an answer on this. I was thinking about a situation where, you know, imagine a summary judgment motion is filed, and let's say you should have won the summary judgment motion. Everybody agrees, but you didn't, and you didn't appeal it. And then the case goes to trial, and you lose a trial. And everybody agrees you should lose a trial. Can you really, on appeal, come to us and ask us to overturn a trial verdict because you should have won an earlier procedural motion? That seems very odd to me.
A summary judgment motion isn't a procedural motion. It's a dispositive motion. And there have been cases in the Court of Appeals affirmed by this court that have taken exactly that course. Typically, the Court of Appeals reviews the summary judgment first before turning to the review of the denial of the directed verdict. And I would say in this case, the Court of Appeals should have decided the summary judgment first.
So you're really asking us to potentially go back, reverse a trial verdict. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that your sufficiency of the evidence argument or directed verdict argument isn't successful, okay? So assume that for the purposes of my question. Are you asking us to overturn the trial verdict separately on the basis of the fact that you should have won summary judgment earlier on then?
Yes. And I think the two decisions go hand in hand, though, Your Honor, that they won't, in this case, they would not be inconsistent. On the summary judgment, that was the first motion in this case, substantively, and under 809.10, all non-final orders are before the court on appeal. The appeals from summary judgment are interlocutory, and the Court of Appeals routinely denies such appeals. And so to be able to raise a denial of summary judgment as an appeal ground on appeal when you've gone to trial, to preserve that, what you need to do is you need to raise the same arguments on the directed verdict motion as you did in the summary judgment, and you need to make sure the jury's decided the issues of fact at trial. If that has been done, then the court should decide the summary judgment first. Court doesn't even need to reach the review of the jury verdict because in the first instance, the trial judge in this case committed error when he merely said there are issues of fact without taking the elements of plaintiff's case and applying them to the facts and seeing if plaintiff has proven this case.
But there obviously are disputed facts, and there were a summary judgment, right?
I mean, I'm sorry, what did you say?
There obviously were disputed facts, right? I mean,
no.
The facts, I mean, you say Woodman's couldn't see this. You say it wasn't there long enough to give rise to constructive notice. The plaintiffs say yes to both of those.
There's no evidence from anyone that Woodman's could see it. The facts are undisputed.
There's no evidence of what?
There's no evidence that Woodman's could see it on the floor. Are there
simple inferences that could be drawn based upon the evidence submitted that Woodman's had notice of this?
There aren't any facts from which an inference could be drawn that Woodman saw the material prior to Mr. Correa falling. All of the evidence is that no one noticed it. People walked by, passed by uneventfully, and nothing occurred.
You're disregarding circumstantial evidence, it sounds like.
No. Circumstantial evidence is like any other evidence. People walking by is circumstantial evidence. If they didn't slip, they didn't fall, they didn't look at it, everybody went about their way, that's circumstantial evidence. That's not direct evidence of when the material fell.
Right,
so we're not disregarding circumstantial evidence.
But it sounds like in order for you to win on your summary judgment argument, you would have to win on the directed verdict argument. You're making the same argument, right?
No, Your Honor. You need to look at the evidence submitted by the parties on summary judgment and the arguments they made. In this case, the plaintiff made arguments that he abandoned at trial. He made the argument. He admitted on summary judgment that there was no substantiated evidence at the length of time of the unsafe condition. He
right.
did not yeah. argue constructive notice based on a length of time. Instead, he argued constructive notice based on the Strack exception to the requirement you have length of time, which requires proof that the merchandising of the particular materials in the grocery store would reasonably lead to an accident and that the operator of the store would see that. Woodman showed that the facts of this case do not fit that exception as a matter of law. So the summary judgment arguments in this case are not the same as the arguments that the plaintiff later made at trial.
Ms. Lawless, with respect to the summary judgment arguments, I'm looking at Ritchie versus Badger State Mutual. Site is 22 with second 133, and it specifically held that by proceeding to a jury trial and not bringing an appeal at that time on the motion for summary judgment that you've waived it. So how do you distinguish?
What year is that case from?
1963.
Well, 1963, appeals, denial of summary judgment was appealable as of right at that time under the state procedural statutes. So if we had that statute now, Woodman certainly would have appealed because it would have the right to appeal the denial of summary judgment as of right. And in we submitted a proposed response to the amicus's brief because that is just not right. There's also subsequent case law that holds the Gross case that holds that even under the prior statute, you don't waive your right to appeal summary judgment denial by not trying to appeal at that moment. As
in
long
which,
as you
which
raise...
Which case is that? Gross?
Yes, Gross. Okay. That's mentioned in the brief. Under the current statute, summary judgment denial is not appealable as of right. And under 809.110, it's one of the orders that can be appealed at the time the rest of the case is appealed. In this case, we would ask on the issue of summary judgment that the court direct that the trial judge is the gatekeeper. Is there evidence of how long the material was there? That would be the gatekeeper issue in this case. In this case, it was admitted in the briefing on summary judgment that there's no substantiated evidence of how long the material was there. Therefore, on summary judgment, Correa conceded that he could not prove constructive notice.
Was the video submitted as part of the summary judgment proceedings?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Now, it's not clear from the hearing transcript whether the trial judge looked at the video or not. I can't tell that, but I would ask that when the court issues its ruling in this case, that it holds that a trial judge is the gatekeeper on summary judgment in cases like this, where the issue is constructive notice and the issue, and a plaintiff must prove some facts tending to bracket how long the dangerous material was there and when it became dangerous. If there's no evidence from which you can see that it was there longer than a couple seconds, it was longer than a minute, it was longer than 10 minutes, then the plaintiff hasn't carried their burden of proving constructive notice.
Counsel, why can't the jury have inferred it was there for longer than 90 minutes?
Because that inference would not be based on facts.
And why?
Because there is no facts showing that the material was there at 90 minutes.
Well, but there was testimony, if I understand it correctly, that nothing was deposited on the floor 90 minutes before the spill, right?
Right.
Okay, so it was on the floor when he slipped. So why isn't that circumstantial evidence? It must have been there longer than 90 minutes.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's evidence. It's merely evidence that it was there when he slipped. There is zero evidence from which a jury
can
infer.
Well, it didn't come out of the floor. It's a substance that was on the floor. So if nobody put it there in 90 minutes, but it's there at the end of 90 minutes when he falls down, Why isn't that circumstantial evidence? It's been there longer than 90 minutes. That's when the employee said they checked it out for 90 minutes and nothing got spilled.
Because all of the other evidence shows that no one slipped on material, no one noticed the material. There's no evidence that it was there.
I know,
it
but would we have to search. We have to search the record for evidence to support the jury's verdict. That's our obligation.
And also on summary judgment, since we've appealed it, the court has an obligation to perform de novo. And given the admissions in this case,
I agree. But you know, you have a different idea of what is involved in constructive notice. I don't know of any case that says if you can't prove the moment a substance appeared on the floor, you can never prove constructive notice. So if there's such a case, you should tell it to me, because that would be a legal principle that I'm not aware of, and that would go to summary judgment in your favor. I don't know of any such case.
All the cases we cite in our brief say merely showing an item was there doesn't prove how long it was there.
I know, but you're saying something different. You're saying he failed in his proof because he didn't show when it was deposited on the floor. I'm not so sure that's the same thing as I'm reading from the cases.
Well, in this case, there's no evidence how long the material was there. Therefore, it would
90
be
90 minutes, right?
Therefore, it would be sheer speculation from the jury to conclude it was there long enough to be discovered and remedied. And because that's the important piece of it. You need proof how long it was there, and the case law for 100 years shows that.
Well, not necessarily. Sometimes we have cases like this, and I think the Kachansky case was like this, where they proved how often Speedway cleaned up the snow. And I think they'd only had an inch and a half or 2 inches, which in Wisconsin is not a heck of a lot that day. But I just don't see that kind of fitting together with what we're talking about today.
Well, Kachansky affirmed all of the principles on which we're relying in this case, including the fact that the plaintiff needs to prove the length of time the hazard was there. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to prove the exact precise moment, but you need to provide facts, not speculation, from which the jury could conclude that the hazard was there. In this case, it's sheer speculation to assume that the material was there at 90 minutes.
I just want to address, just give you an opportunity to just again briefly address the summary judgment piece. So there was an argument in the amicus that the United States Supreme Court recognized there was a circuit split on this question of whether you could hear this, and their representation is that the U.S. Supreme Court in Ortiz v. Jordan said that this summary judgment retains its interlocutory character as simply a step along the route to final judgment. Once the case proceeds to trial, the full record developed in court supersedes the record existing at the time of the summary judgment motion. The amicus says our rules are obviously modeled after the federal rules. Are you asking us to adopt a different rule than the U.S. Supreme Court, or is the amicus incorrect for the proposition that it's stating with regard to federal law?
The amicus is incorrect for a number of reasons. Our summary judgment rule and the federal one are not the same. They have different sections, different portions. Further, Wisconsin law, by statute, provides that parties may appeal non-final orders as part of their appeal from the final judgment in the case. And finally, the Supreme Court case, the U.S. Supreme Court case cited, relates to qualified immunity. And that case involved a situation where there wasn't a directed verdict argument reiterating the same arguments, or there wasn't a Rule 50 motion. So that was part of the problem, that the qualified immunity issue wasn't properly preserved. In Wisconsin, because we have the right by statute to appeal, this court should not follow federal law when it has clear state procedural law that governs. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, did you concede at summary judgment that the substance was not on the floor long enough that it would have been reasonable to require Woodman's to clean it up?
No, Your Honor. My wording at the summary judgment phase was no substantiated evidence. And I think that was a poorly worded way to say no direct evidence. And certainly I did not mean to say that there was no circumstantial evidence or no inferences that could be drawn from that circumstantial evidence. As this court is certainly well aware, the standard of review for that summary judgment issue is de novo, meaning the court can look at the entirety of the record. And I think it's important to highlight, and I think Justice Kelly hit upon it accurately, is at the summary judgment phase, the circuit court had every piece of evidence in front of it that was later heard by the jury at trial. The video was available to the circuit court, testimony of Buckner, the Woodman's employee Hayes, and the plaintiff testified. Those were all of the pieces of evidence before the judge at the summary judgment phase. And while the judge specifically relied upon the so-called Strack exception at summary judgment, this court has consistently held, including the Genrich v. Zurich Insurance Company case, that the courts can rule on the summary judgment based upon the arguments of counsel or even a sua sponte, look at the evidence to determine that there's a genuine issue of material fact.
Are you disputing the point that's being made by Ms. Lawless that we can review this on summary judgment?
I think it's a question
or
that
can
looks
review. I should have said that wrong. We can review the summary judgment finding at this stage.
The case that counsel relied upon, and I think Your Honor mentioned it, does say specifically that unless you take an interlocutory appeal from a summary judgment ruling, that issue is waived later on. And I will acknowledge that the summary judgment statute has changed since then, as counsel acknowledged. I don't know if that changes the status of that law. But I think, as Justice Hagedorn alluded to, there is plenty of federal authority that addresses this, and including the Supreme Court case acknowledged by Justice Hagedorn and also the Seventh Circuit case of Watson v. Demco Steel, which essentially stands for the proposition of it's a fiction. It's a logical fallacy to go back and look at evidence when there's a fuller context of evidence, specifically after a jury trial.
See, I think it depends on why summary judgment was granted or not granted. If it's based on a legal principle where the plaintiff can never recover, no matter what evidence you put in, I think that's always reviewable if the judge goofs up and it goes to a jury and the jury comes in with the verdict in favor of the plaintiff. The plaintiff can still ask for motions after verdict to set the verdict aside because there's no way that the plaintiff could recover. So I don't think there's any law anywhere, the federal or state, that says if you have a legal principle that bars the plaintiff's recovery and the judge goofs up on it first time through, it goes to the jury, for whatever reason the jury gives you a verdict, that's reviewable, that principle. But here what we're arguing about was there enough evidence presented on summary judgment? Was there enough evidence presented at trial? That's not a legal principle, it's fact specific.
I would agree.
I think we're off in the woods someplace on this.
I would agree with you, and I think that harkens back to the general principle that this court has stated over and over, that negligence cases are very rarely, if ever, appropriate for summary judgment, because there are always going to be some facts in dispute, and if there aren't specific facts in dispute, there is potential circumstantial evidence that is out there and always the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that circumstantial evidence. And that goes back to what I think the circuit court did for highlighting one reason why summary judgment was inappropriate. I don't think we can necessarily infer from that another reason wasn't appropriate as well. And as a closing point, I do want to be clear on exactly what Correa is asking this court to do. We are not asking this court to overturn long-established principles set forth in Meagel or Kaufman or even Kachansky. We're asking this court to address the appellate court review in this and determine that it perhaps took a conclusion of Kachansky that there was no evidence and it tried to apply these specific facts to it in a way that was inappropriate. There are certainly substantial facts that the jury could have relied upon and more appropriately inferences from those facts, both circumstantial and direct, to sustain the jury verdicts. And if the Court of Appeals standard is any credible evidence, certainly there was that in order to sustain this jury verdict.
Thank you. Thank you both for very good briefs and a very interesting argument. You both did a fine job, really, in case.
We are going to take a break now, and the court will come back at 1:30, our third case of the day. We are adjourned.